Good evening. I am Eugene Meyer, President of the Federalist Society, and Thank you. And I want to welcome you all to the 7th Annual Barbara Olson Memorial Lecture. Earlier this month, I visited the Pentagon 9/11 Memorial. It was a painful refresher in what we have lost, and on a personal basis, seeing the name Barbara K. Olson on the plaque was especially poignant. This memorial lecture series started, as many of you know, with Ted Olson's inaugural lecture, which reminded us of what it means to be an American and how our legal tradition is a critical part of our identity as Americans. Lawyers are at their best when they recognize this connection between law and our American identity. Both Ted and Barbara understood this connection. We want the lecture series to remind lawyers of it so that they foster legal principles that advance individual freedom, personal responsibility, and the rule of law. We are also delighted today to have with us not only Ted and his wife, Lady, but also his mother and stepfather. Thank you both for being here. Ted's inaugural lecture was followed by Ken Starr, Judge Robert Bork, Justice Scalia, Judge Randolph, and Vice President Cheney. We're very pleased by the distinguished lectures we have had, and even more pleased to have the honor of hosting the Chief Justice today. This conference that we're having this weekend and this lecture series both focus partially on what is special about America. One of the things that is unique is a system of carefully separated powers. In his hearings, Chief Justice Roberts discussed the role of the judiciary under that system as being one of an umpire. It is not that he lacks the ability or the willingness to take strong positions. As one who has argued 39 cases before the Supreme Court, he has done that often and usually with great success. Of course, sometimes the circumstances have been difficult or challenging. He was famously asked if one case he had lost 9-0, why that had been the result, and responded that there had been only 9 justices. As a Harvard Law School graduate and clerk for Justice Rehnquist on the Supreme Court, in addition to his extensive experience in the Solicitor General's office and at Hogan and Hartston, he has sterling credentials and much experience in taking such strong positions. Indeed, he was widely thought to be the leading Supreme Court advocate of his generation when he was elevated to the Court of Appeals and then the Supreme Court. But he's now taken on a different role. As any serious sports fan will attest, the role of an umpire is a critical one, but thankless. A good judge will decide cases from time to time where not only many of us in this room won't like the result, but often that good judge won't like it either. But if the decision is correct, the problem is with Congress, or perhaps occasionally we don't like something in the Constitution. Those are political problems. His task is to make sure that the pitch just a little bit outside is not called a strike just because the pitcher is likable or has a heartrending story. I am honored to introduce you to a man who is well-suited by experience, judgment, ability, and temperament to call them as he sees them, which is all that can be asked, the Chief Justice of the United States, the Honorable John Roberts.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for that very warm welcome. And thank you, Gene, for that generous introduction. I'm very pleased to be here among friends, old and new, to deliver the 7th Annual Barbara Olson Lecture. Barbara was a good friend, and I consider it an honor to deliver the lecture named after her. Whenever I think of Barbara, my first reaction is to smile. I suspect that is true of many of those who knew her. And what a testament that is to her life. Despite the horror and savagery that took her from us, her life shines through and triumphs over that evil. Barbara brought courage to her convictions, and she inspires each of us to have the courage of our own. The Barbara Olson Lecture Series is dedicated to two distinctly American ideals that Barbara held dear: limited government and the spirit of freedom. The Federalist Society quite properly looks to the Constitution as our nation's foremost statement of principles that constrain government and preserve liberty. For that reason, I've decided to speak a little bit this evening about James Madison. I figured the subject was a safe bet for this audience. Madison, after all, was the father of our Constitution, the father of the Bill of Rights, the author of more than one-third of the Federalist Papers, and, of course, the guy on the Society's ties. No one wrote more persuasively than James Madison in Federalist 39 and Federalist 51 in defense of the separation of powers, including the importance of an independent, life-tenure judiciary in the Constitution's scheme. Tonight, I would like to talk briefly about an aspect of Madison that typically receives little attention: his judicial appointments as the nation's fourth president to the Supreme Court. Madison's biographers have given his two judicial appointments to the court relatively brief treatment. For example, Ralph Ketchum's 600-plus page biography of Madison makes no mention at all of his Supreme Court selections. And Irving Brant's 6-volume biography of Madison devotes fewer than 6 pages to the matter. Now, there's perhaps good reason why Madison's biographers have not focused on this aspect of Madison's presidency. Madison himself was preoccupied with other issues. When Chief Justice Marshall administered the presidential oath to Madison on March 4, 1809, the pressing issues were matters of war and peace. The United States had attempted to maintain its neutrality in the ongoing conflict between Britain and France through an unpopular and unsuccessful trade embargo. President Madison was immediately consumed, as chief executive, with the same foreign affairs issues that had occupied him when he was Jefferson's Secretary of State. You will recall that Madison's predecessor as Secretary of State had been Marshall himself, and that Marshall had left some unfinished State Department business for Madison to take care of, including the delivery of some commissions. Now, one can easily imagine Chief Justice Marshall telling President Madison at his inauguration that he need not concern himself with the Supreme Court. After all, Marshall could point out that Madison had been a successful litigant in that court 6 years earlier, and, since issuing its decision in Marbury versus Madison, the court was managing its own affairs quite well. Madison might even have heeded that advice. He did not share Jefferson's overt hostility toward the Marshall Court. As a matter of principle, Madison recognized the need for a strong and independent judiciary. As a Republican, he, of course, had differences with Marshall's nationalist vision, but the differences in historic perspective were principled and measured. As Professor Gordon Wood pointed out in his recent book, Revolutionary Characters, part of Madison's nationalist vision was a greater appreciation than many of his fellow Republicans of the role of the Supreme Court. Now, on a personal level, Madison and Marshall were friendly. Madison did not share Jefferson's abiding suspicion of Marshall. That suspicion is best captured in the advice that Jefferson gave to one of Marshall's judicial colleagues. Jefferson said, and I quote, "When conversing with Marshall, I never admit anything. So sure as you admit any position to be good, no matter how remote from the conclusion he seeks to establish, you are gone. So great is his sophistry that you must never give him an affirmative answer, or you will be forced to grant his conclusion." Why, if he were to ask me if it were daylight or not, I'd reply, "Sir, I do not know. I can't tell." We have some advocates like that before the court these days. Now, Jefferson's advice, which sounds a lot like a Miranda warning, stands in sharp contrast to Madison's confidence in Marshall. Together, Marshall and Madison had actively advocated ratification of the Constitution at the Virginia Convention, and Madison deferred to Marshall for the presentation and defense of Article III. For his part, Marshall had watched Madison successfully respond to Patrick Henry's soaring oratory through fastidious preparation and careful logic. Marshall later stated, quoting, "If I were called upon to say who, of all the men I have known, had the greatest power to convince, I should perhaps say Mr. Madison." Now, whether he wanted to or not, President Madison did need to turn his attention to the Supreme Court some 18 months after his inauguration. Associate Justice William Cushing of Massachusetts, who had turned down President Washington's nomination as Chief Justice in 1796 because of, as he put it, his infirm and declining state of health, had long outlived his own prognosis. He nevertheless did pass away on September 13, 1810, and Madison faced the task of choosing a successor. By all accounts, the matter started out poorly. Former President Jefferson, whom Chief Justice Marshall called the Great Llama of the Mountain, promptly weighed in on the matter from Monticello, issuing highly partisan advice. Custom and the obligations of circuit riding at the time called for a nominee from New England. But Jefferson held deep suspicions about New England lawyers, and his views were further tainted by New England's opposition to his unsuccessful embargo. Jefferson urged Madison to replace Cushing from among the New England Republicans who had strongly supported Jefferson's trade restrictions. That list, however, was bound to be short. New England remained a Federalist stronghold, and even many of New England's Republicans had opposed the embargo, which was widely unpopular in New England. Jefferson also appeared to harbor suspicions about another matter, the Supreme Court's decision 5 months earlier in Fletcher versus Peck. Fletcher, like Marbury, is, of course, a landmark decision. It confirmed the court's authority to strike down state statutes as unconstitutional. In a characteristically deft opinion, Marshall concluded that a Georgia statute invalidating a prior Georgia legislature's corrupt sale of the so-called Yazoo lands, embracing most of present-day Alabama and Mississippi, violated the contract clause. Jefferson and Madison had intimate familiarity with this long-simmering scandal, a scandal that pitted Georgia against the land claimants, including both northern land companies who demanded the benefit of their bargain, and third parties who had purchased land from those companies. Just to review the facts very briefly, in 1795, Georgia legislators sold 35 million acres of present-day Alabama and Mississippi very cheaply to northern land speculators at about 1.5 cents per acre. Now, many of those speculators promptly resold the lands to third parties. Georgia's title to the land was debatable, and the individual legislators profited handsomely from the sale. The rascals were thrown out, of course, in the next election, and the subsequent legislature rescinded the sale. This precipitated a vigorous public debate and, then as it would now, the inevitable lawsuits. In 1801, President Jefferson had appointed Madison, his Secretary of the Treasury, Albert Gallatin, and his Attorney General, Levi Lincoln, to a commission to recommend a solution. They proposed a complex compromise that was basically a federal bailout. Georgia would cede the Yazoo lands to the United States in exchange for a payment. The United States would partially compensate the purchasers, and the United States would hold the land for the creation of future states. Congress, however, was unwilling to act on that proposal, and the litigation went forward. Jefferson had no sympathy for the Northern land companies, and he viewed Marshall's decision overruling the Georgia statute and reviving their claims as yet another example of judicial arrogance. Now, many of the potential Supreme Court nominees from New England had connections to the land purchasers in the Fletcher litigation. In Jefferson's words, they were all infected with Yazooism, an affliction that nowadays turns up only at Scrabble championships. Jefferson first encouraged Madison to replace Cushing with his former Attorney General, Levi Lincoln, who'd served with Madison on this Yazoo Commission. But the elderly Lincoln, who was nearly blind from cataracts, resisted. Madison nominated him anyway, and the Senate promptly confirmed him in January 1811, but Lincoln steadfastly refused to serve. Madison next turned to Alexander Wolcott, a federal revenue collector in Connecticut who had vigorously supported Jefferson's embargo. Wolcott, an outspoken party operative, satisfied Jefferson's criteria, but he was widely unpopular, as revenue collectors tend to be. The Senate soundly rejected him on February 13, 1811, by a vote of 9 in favor and 24 against. Now, at this point, Madison began to retreat from Jefferson's partisan advice. He turned to a person from outside the ranks of solid Jeffersonian Republicans, a person who had, in fact, been a Federalist, but now was an independent who leaned toward Republican principles, John Quincy Adams. Madison had developed a special kinship with Adams, who had bucked popular sentiment in Massachusetts and had supported the trade embargo. Now, if I could have just a moment for an aside, I should point out that chief justices also have a special kinship with John Quincy Adams. There is in the office that chief justices have traditionally used off the conference room at the Supreme Court, there is a sofa that is the sofa on which John Quincy Adams died. He was on the floor of the House when he had a stroke and was taken to this sofa. And, of course, at the time, the court met in the basement of the Capitol. The sofa made its way there and moved over with the court in 1935. In any event, Madison had already displayed confidence in Adams by appointing him the president's minister to Russia. Madison promptly nominated Adams to the Supreme Court on February 21, 1811, 8 days after Wolcott's nomination was rejected. Madison did not wait for Adams' assent. He was, after all, halfway around the world in St. Petersburg. The Senate promptly and unanimously confirmed Adams. But Adams, a consummate politician, had different plans. When the news reached him, he responded from St. Petersburg that he did not want the job. Adams, who had presidential ambitions, humbly wrote to Madison, quote, "I have long entertained a deep and serious distrust of my qualifications for a seat on the bench." Now, Chief Justice Marshall, who had been appointed Chief Justice by Adams's father, concurred in Adams's self-evaluation. He told a confidant, with reference to Adams, that nothing is more to be deprecated than the transfer of party politics to the seat of justice. Now, President Madison, by this point, clearly faced an embarrassing situation. He'd lost his first nominee to physical infirmity, his second to resounding rejection, and his third to political ambition. To complicate matters further, Associate Justice Chase died, creating a second vacancy, and the Supreme Court was unable to sit for its 1811 term for lack of a quorum. Now, at this point, Madison broke cleanly from Jefferson's guidance. He nominated two individuals who are now among the famous justices of the 19th century, albeit for very different reasons, Gabriel Duval and Joseph Story. It happens that he made the joint nominations 196 years ago yesterday, and the Senate confirmed them both unanimously the next business day. That's right, the next business day. Gabriel Duval, a 59-year-old former judge from Maryland, replaced fellow Marylander Chase. As I noted earlier, geographic considerations played a very large role in Supreme Court nominations at the time. Duval had served both Jefferson and Madison as the Comptroller of the Treasury, where he had earned Madison's confidence for calm competence. He gained his fame far more recently, however, as the subject of a Chicago Law School academic commentary. Professor David Curry, who sadly passed away last month, suggested in the 50th anniversary issue of the University of Chicago Law Review that Justice Duval was the least significant justice in the history of the Supreme Court, at least up till then. But Justice Duval was not without his defenders on the Chicago faculty. Professor Curry's colleague, Frank Easterbrook, immediately rose to Duval's defense. He wrote a strongly worded rebuttal identifying several other justices that were even less significant. As Professor Easterbrook put it, he was not about to let Curry's choice stand, quote, without serious consideration of candidates so shrouded in obscurity that they escaped proper attention, even in a contest of insignificance. Now, I am not going to enter into this titanic debate. And I hesitate even to talk about Justice Duval for the fear that I might elevate his significance and deprive him of the source of his fame. And I do realize that with only 2 years of service on the court, the balloting for the title may still be open. But I can't resist just a few words. Historians agree that Justice Duval was a warm and congenial colleague on the Marshall Court. A fellow justice described him as urbane and courteous, with a gentle manner, firm integrity, independence, and sound judgment. We don't know how much he participated in Marshall's robust conference discussions, but he did write several significant decisions involving non-constitutional issues. For example, the author of a biographical sketch, a full Duval biography has yet to be attempted, suggested that Duval's main contribution to the law may be that he, quote, is the architect of the federal rule that the ordinary practice of permitting first the debtor and alternatively the creditor to choose to which among competing obligations a payment should be applied did not pertain when different sureties under distinct obligations were interested. At the court, of course, that is known as the Duval rule. Now, Justice Duval contributed only two words to the court's published constitutional jurisprudence, specifically, I dissent in the Dartmouth College case. Now, I have to say, I find this sort of brevity admirable. Duval chose trenchant words so carefully that even the great Chief Justice John Marshall chose to say nothing in reply. Now, finally, I would add that if judges adhered to the medical profession's adage, first, do no harm, then Justice Duval's reticence served the nation well, better than some of the pronouncements of other 19th century justices. Don't forget that the next justice from Maryland, Roger Taney, said too much rather than too little. Now, President Madison's other appointment, Joseph Story, found fame through more familiar means, extraordinary talent and industry. Although only 32 years old, the youngest appointee in Supreme Court history, he was at the time already known as one of Massachusetts's most able lawyers. He'd recently been elected Speaker of the Massachusetts House of Representatives, and had previously served in Congress as a Republican representative from Massachusetts. They had those back then. Jefferson had urged Madison not to appoint Story because Story had vocally opposed Jefferson's embargo. Jefferson wrote Madison that Story was unquestionably a Tory and too young. It seems likely that Jefferson also took no comfort in the fact that Story, together with John Quincy Adams, had successfully represented the northern land purchasers in Fletcher versus Peck. Jefferson's views, however, had lost their hold on Madison, and they failed to dissuade him from selecting Story. Rather, after three failed nominations, Madison now appeared to be guided by his own lights. He most likely saw in Story a person of merit and compatible outlook who would be confirmed. Story's biographer suggests that Madison perceived that Story was admirably qualified and saw a congeniality between his own and Story's nationalism. Madison, a serious scholar who himself rose to prominence at an early age, could easily see much to admire in Story. Story had a compulsive appetite for learning, relentlessly studying 14 hours a day at Harvard, allegedly dousing his head in cold water at night to maintain his attention. He was well-versed in the classics, poetry, and history, as well as Blackstone and Cook. By the time of his appointment, he'd already written a well-received treatise on civil litigation and had developed expertise in commercial and maritime law. Story had a prodigious memory and was a veritable walking library, something the court needed, since at the time of Story's appointment, Congress did not allow the court to use the Library of Congress. That, I think, was carrying the separation of powers too far. Now, Madison may have thought that Story, as a Republican, would provide an intellectual counterweight to Marshall, the Federalist. But if Madison had expected that Story would decide cases on the basis of party politics, then he was surely misguided. Story came to the court with the steadfast belief that the court was above and apart from the political fray. Story repeatedly stated that law and politics were distinct and that he felt far more comfortable in the world of law. From early in his career, he had spoken of law as a science in the sense that legal decisions proceed from the consistent and rational application of principles set down in the Constitution, statutes, and prior precedent. In that sense, Story's views were aligned with the ideals that Madison had identified in Federalist 39 and that Hamilton had eloquently expressed in Federalist 78. Far from being political adversaries, Marshall and Story understood that they were judicial colleagues and that they were engaged in a joint enterprise that transcended party politics and regionalism. They shared a common nationalist vision. In addition, their talents complemented each other. Marshall reasoned somewhat instinctively, while Story relied on careful analysis of legal authorities. As Story put it, "When I examine a question, I go from headland to headland. Marshall has a compass, puts out to sea, and goes directly to the result." Now, despite their different approaches to navigation, Marshall and Story, during their nearly quarter century of service together, most often arrived at the same place. Story added another ingredient to the court's mix that deserves mention. He wrote poetry while on the bench, including verses inspired by the lawyers who argued before the court. Now, I think we have a very talented Supreme Court bar today, but I cannot say that they have ever inspired me to write poetry. Story, however, offered these lines of what he expected of advocates before the court. "Begin with dignity, expound with grace, each ground of reasoning in its time and place. Let order reign throughout each topic touch, nor urge its power too little or too much." Now, of course, not all advocates lived up to that standard. Story offered these lines describing what he too often encountered. "With just enough learning to confuse, with just enough of temper to abuse, with just enough of genius when confessed to urge the worst of passions for the best." Now, I have to tell you that Story's poetry from the bench has not received literary acclaim. But it does have a certain timeless quality among the justices, and I am quite certain that the lawyers who appeared before Story told him it was brilliant. The poetry aside, there can be little dispute that Madison's appointment of Joseph Story strengthened the Marshall Court immeasurably. The process that led to Story's appointment perhaps reflects the truth about Madison. History records that Madison was often indecisive at the outset of a crisis, a quality that did not serve him well as president. But Madison always worked steadily toward a solution. As one of Madison's close colleagues put it, "Mr. Madison is slow in taking his ground, but firm when the storm arises." Madison's initial reliance on Jefferson's advice deterred, but did not prevent, Madison from eventually selecting Story as the best of the available candidates. Madison ultimately showed his good judgment in rejecting Jefferson's litmus test respecting a potential nominee's attitude toward a prominent political issue of the day, the trade embargo. And Madison wisely did not eliminate from consideration a lawyer who, in representing clients, had advocated positions with which Madison disagreed in the Fletcher case. At the end of the day, Madison surely took account of the nominee's general judicial philosophy, but he also focused on the nominee's talent and record of accomplishments. The Marshall Court that Madison helped to shape played a critical role in directing the future of the Union. It decided landmark cases, such as McCullough against Maryland, Martin versus Hunter's lessee, and, over Justice Duval's dissent, Dartmouth College. Now, those decisions were probably not all to President Madison's liking. Madison, however, was the architect of limited government and separated powers. He knew, better than anyone, that the principle of separated powers requires an independent judiciary. His appointment of Joseph Story helped ensure that we would have one. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chief Justice, for a wonderful lecture. We deeply appreciate it and deeply appreciate your coming. I'm sure Barbara would be honored. And our reception is across the hall, and we'll proceed forthwith. Thank you all for coming. Good evening.